I think that's my cue to start and to welcome you all. You're the ones who obviously couldn't get into Mary Beard, so I apologise for that. I think that says an awful lot about public service broadcasting, that she's sold out and we have a small but perfectly formed audience. I'm also looking to see if there is anybody here under a certain age, and I'm not going to name that age. But again, I think this says an awful lot about public service broadcasting as well. My name's Torrin Douglas. I was the BBC's media correspondent for more years than I care to remember. 5 years ago, I was let off for good behaviour, and I now speak and write and chair events. And it's my pleasure to welcome you here to this festival. How many of you have been to another event already here? Good. I don't need to do the general preamble about what this festival is all about, but we're particularly delighted that you're here for the Future of Public Service Broadcasting discussion. And I'm really pleased to be joined here by Andrew Billen from The Times and Professor James Bennett from the Royal Holloway University, London. Andrew is the Chief TV critic, that's out of date already, isn't
it?
Yeah, that's a date, well out of date. He used to be, he'll tell you why he's no longer the TV critic, if that comes up, if he's allowed to. But he was the chief TV critic for quite a number of years, and he was a feature writer. And you will have seen his interviews are still in the Times, and he had one today which was all about educating Greater Manchester, or the head that who's just left there. He first worked for the Times in the 80s, was the arts correspondent. He moved to work for The Observer and The Standard, London Evening Standard, returned to the Times to write a weekly feature, and in his spare time he wrote TV reviews for The New Statesman, and is now theatre critic for the same, or is this still an old biog?
I think this is a very old Wikipedia entry.
Ignore everything I have said. Basically, he is still a feature.
He writes
for the Times, and he has interviewed very recently Graham Norton and quite a few other very prominent television people. But as a TV critic over the past how many years?
Well, I did 10 years for The Statesman for the lefties, and I did 10 years for The Times for
that's
the righties.
Right.
So 20 years. Man and boy.
He does know what he's talking about. Professor James Bennett is professor in television and digital culture and former head of media arts at Royal Holloway University. He's the principal investigator on the Social Media as Television Production Technology project as part of their ADAPT TV history research. His work focuses on the production cultures and shape of television and celebrity in digital culture. And he also has a new project, which I'm going to ask him to explain. But he's really looking at the whole cutting edge of television and in this new digital world, how all that that hangs together. There's going to be lots of opportunity for you to ask questions, make comments, and I hope you will. So just wave at me at any time. But I'm going to chat to them for about half an hour or so. If there's something that comes up during that time, feel free just to wave and we'll get you involved. But then it's over to you with questions, and I've got lots if you run out. So that's fine. But I thought I would start, show how topical this subject is. This was Andrew's paper yesterday. There was a speech by Charlotte Moore, who is the BBC's head of content, and she gave a lecture on Thursday night, which got a lot of coverage on Friday, yesterday's papers. Greedy streaming services fail to put viewers first, BBC chief insists. And basically she's saying that they're the Netflixes and the Googles and the Amazons and the Facebooks are really interested in profit, and they use all sorts of digital technology to create their programs, and the BBC does not. She also said that Bodyguard, how many people here watch Bodyguard? Thank you. How many people watch Vanity Fair? Thank you. So Bodyguard is the most popular drama hit in over a decade, and we'll talk a bit about that. But first of all, I thought I'd ask you, Andrew, and then you, James, what did you make of what Charlotte Moore was saying, that actually these streaming services are a danger to the BBC?
Well, she's saying more than that, isn't she? She's saying they're evil, or they're venal. They've got this acronym, haven't they? FANGs.
FANGs.
Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix.
And Google.
And Google. They're the enemy. Well, last night I watched two FANG programmes. There was Matthew Viner's Romanoffs, who's the guy who did Mad Men, and then those on Facebook, which isn't even really a streaming service, but it seems to have a streaming channel now. A small half-hour drama about a young woman who's lost her husband. It's like it's a series. It's called I'm Sorry for Your Loss. And it was like invented a new thing, the Sitz Trage. It was just half an hour, but very acutely written. And if I was the author of that, or if I was Matthew Viner, I would be absolutely furious with Charlotte Moore for saying that his creativity was being sold to us by means of an algorithm. It's very mean-minded of her not to be able to accept that any patron of creativity is not to be welcomed. I think it's an extraordinarily aggressive comment for her to make, but also very typical of any organisation, any shop, any business that's threatened with a rival moving into town. Their first thing, I'm sure Adam Smith would agree with this, their first thing to do is to attack it and try and drive it out of business, in this example, by a really quite specious attempt at almost Presbyterian morality.
Discuss. James,
I think Andrew's right in terms of like the competition isn't necessarily a bad thing at all. Like, you know, more places for creative people to get their work made, if that encourages a strong British production base to tell great stories, then that's good. And I think actually the challenge of Netflix and Amazon is in this space is really for the BBC and Channel 4 etc. to respond with how they offer their programming as distinct and separate from those services. So, in particular, how the algorithms that she's talking about of serving up content to audiences could be different in a public service world, so that you don't end up with, like you do when you watch Netflix, you watch one program and then you're immediately within 5 seconds starting the next program, or you're being recommended more of the same kind of programming. And I think the challenge for public service broadcasters is to develop algorithms that are different to that, that operate in a space where consumption and just keep viewing aren't the only metrics of success, but instead how you inspire and engage audiences. So a public service algorithm would be a better response from the BBC to show how the iPlayer offers people a wide range of experiences rather than, you know, competing for the same audiences or the same type of territory.
Thanks. In fact, the BBC has said that's what it's going to do. last week, the Director General, Tony Hall, gave a speech setting out what he wanted to do. And to just expand on the threat as they see it, the BBC's money, he says, has gone down in a decade by 18% in real terms, at the time when all of these hugely well-funded rivals are starting, though in fact we will discuss a bit about whether they're as well funded as everybody says. We were talking back there about whether there really is as much money being ploughed into, say, the Crown as everybody likes to think. But it is a genuine threat that the big bucks are on the sides of the fangs, and the BBC has somehow got to create great drama with fewer bucks. How do you think it should do that?
Big bucks. I mean, they say now that Netflix is spending $8 billion on original programming. It also owes $8 billion in debt. You know, you might switch on TV tomorrow and find it's gone the way of Patisserie Valerie. It may just be a bubble that's going to burst, and they're going to be left with Sunday night thrillers on BBC One to watch. So I think it's premature to worry about that. The thing about Netflix and Amazon is they have to earn every single penny to pay off and service this debt. Charlotte Moore, I call her Moore because I'm Scottish. She calls herself Moore. Charlotte Moore has £4 billion every year, guaranteed, when she has to give some of it to radio, which is taken from the licence fee. That is a tremendous place to start from if you want to start commissioning some interesting drama. And she has. I think her taste in drama has proved pretty good over the last few years. It's only in Britain, possibly only in Scotland, that we will be gathering here in a state of funereal mourning when we could equally be somewhere sunny, possibly like Australia, and celebrating a golden age of television that we are undoubtedly, probably for the first time in my life, living through.
And to be fair, in the same speech, he did say that the quality of drama has gone up as a result of this this money. How many people here have Netflix? And how many people here have Amazon Prime? A few, right. Okay, we're getting a measure of it, because we will go into a discussion about how Netflix is used and things like that. So, James, looking at it from your point of view, is it a golden age, or is it something we, in terms of those interested in public service broadcasting, should be worried about?
I think there is a clear and present danger that perhaps Charlotte Moore is overplaying, but the way in which Netflix have driven up production budgets in drama in particular, without having a firm financial basis for an ongoing investment in this market, represents something of a period in which, when that money becomes due, that Andrew was talking about, that debt becomes due, there's going to be a problem in terms of how British productions are then funded, and how British productions at the moment, there's a kind of inflation of those costs. And we're looking, on the one hand, of golden period age of drama, which is great, and there's some great television out there. But also that also creates a drive towards, I guess, inevitable co-production. And the co-production might sound, you know, a great idea. Maybe we could partner with the Fangs, you know, collaborate rather than see them as predators. But then, of course, you know, what's distinct and unusual about the BBC is that mission to service the home audience first and think about that audience first, whereas a co-production thinks about a global market, thinks about resale, and that is always a balancing act. And I think that those things make it economically a very challenging time for maintaining a long-term future in this drama space.
There's a lot of demand, clearly, for TV drama right now, which is sort of funny, because 15 years ago I was told that television drama was dead and we'd spend our time watching Love Island and Celebrity Big Brother because real people were more interesting than anything that could be invented by a dramatist. But here we are, it's the new rock and roll drama. Everybody wants a lot of it. And that means directors who were scrabbling around for work 5 years ago are now in almost constant demand. Oh, just come over and do two episodes of some apocalyptic fantasy on Netflix, and then come back and do something set in the Arctic for Sky, two or three episode gigs. And they can charge a lot more than they did. And I assume that goes for the talent, the acting talent as well. But I was talking to somebody who made TV titles for TV programs, really big shows like Walking the Dead. And he said, how much do you think I get for a BBC big production drama, thriller, Sunday night, for a title? And they're beautifully done, these animated titles now. I mean, they're works of art in their own right. And I said, I don't know, 100,000, something, 12,000, 14,000 from his little production office. You know, it's a myth to think that all the costs have greatly escalated, because these things are, Charlotte Moore's right to one extent, they are run partly by money men who will be trying to suppress costs the whole time as well. And as for, do Netflix really spend all the money that they say they do? I did interview Peter Morgan, who wrote The Crown, and I said it looks so wonderful, but then you have more money to spend on your television programme than any producer in the history of television has had to spend. And he said, it costs exactly the same to make the episode of A Crown as it does to make an episode of Endeavour.
Because there was a huge, great hype, you'll remember, when The Crown was launched for the first series, and they say it was 100 million for 10 episodes. Actually, I think the 100 million was for the two series and so on.
Figures come out. Yeah. I imagine some PR sort of whispers it over a drink. It goes into print. They never deny it. Who would deny it? You know, we're spending £100 million on you, the viewer, and you're only spending £7.95 a month on us. You know, we're your friends. Mm.
Having said that, I run a book festival in London, in Chiswick, which is where Vanity Fair opens. So we were very keen to do a Vanity Fair event at the book festival. And we were very lucky to get the screenwriter Gwyneth Hughes, John Sutherland, the professor, who is one of the experts on Thackeray, and one of the cast, Claudia Jessi, who played Amelia. So we had a fantastic discussion about the making of Vanity Fair on ITV. What I hadn't realised is that when they were writing the script originally, it was only being funded by ITV, and Amazon hadn't yet got involved, and it's now an ITV and Amazon co-production, and Amazon will sell it all over the world. And Gwyneth Hughes said, we were really wondering how on earth we were going to do the Battle of Waterloo, which all previous dramatisations had ducked, basically, because how do you screen the Battle of Waterloo? And she said, we thought we were going to do it in the ad break, and you'd come back and the Battle of Waterloo would be over. And then she said... And then Amazon came over, like the cavalry over the horizon, throwing money at us, and they wanted a big Battle of Waterloo. And in fact, you interviewed one of the
Gwyneth, and yeah. She said, yeah, if Amazon wants the Battle of Waterloo, Amazon can have the Battle of Waterloo. But there's a kind of semi-serious point to it, that when Thackeray wrote it, he just deliberately got rid of the Battle of Waterloo in half a sentence, in a clause at the end of a sentence. While George lies dying on the fields of Waterloo. That was all the Battle of Waterloo there was in terms of action. So ITV, were in its parsimony, was nearer to the spirit of the book than Amazon with its big budgets. On the other hand, maybe people like the Battle of Waterloo.
Well, it's a very good well example of that co-production issue of, like, you know, you come in and you throw money at it because it looks great on screen. Mm. And I'm not saying you have to be authentic to the book to make a great adaptation, but it does change... You know, it's that's aimed at a particular market, isn't it? It's going, right, we have bells and whistles and bangs and explosions and a big battle because that's what's going to draw in the market. Mm. And that's exactly what public service broadcasting isn't meant to be. It isn't meant to worry about whether it's going to draw in the market per se or speak to that market, but can innovate in different ways. And I think it's a really pertinent example of why it's a golden age, but it comes with a price, you know.
It comes with an old gold.
Yeah.
So we had this... battle between Bodyguard and Vanity Fair at the start of the season. And Vanity Fair was on ITV, and everybody normally assumes that costume dramas are on the BBC, so that was unusual. Vanity Fair spent an absolute fortune on marketing the show. They got lots of covers of the TV review sections. Andrew hadn't seen this till I pointed it out to him just a few minutes ago. The Times and the Telegraph both used exactly the same headline, Vanity Fair with added va-va-voom. He said somebody should have been fired for...
That's my
using,
article there.
That's right.
Passes. It's like I've passed off somebody else's piece.
That's right, but his one is a fortnight later than that one. The reason I'm showing these is
just
because...
It's embarrassment.
No, it's to commiserate with you, but to show just how much exposure there was for Vanity Fair in newspapers. The Mail had it all over. I mean, there was... And these pictures of the red coat and Olivia Cooke as Becky Shaw were everywhere. It was also promoted in the World Cup ad breaks. ITV spent an absolute fortune. They then
London
Underground posters. They did wraparounds around newspapers. I've no idea what they spent, but they spent a huge amount. This was meant to be, what it says here, is this the drama of the autumn? No, it wasn't. Because Bodyguard, which had no promotion at all, absolutely knocked it out of the water and had huge audiences. Now, my question to these two is, which was the public service broadcasting? Was Bodyguard public service broadcasting? Was Vanity Fair? Does it matter, James?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can never... Whether it's a hit or not is not public service broadcasting. I think what you want in that space is the opportunity for public service broadcasters to take risks and to innovate and to accept that sometimes that leads to failure across a whole bunch of spaces, including drama, but also innovation in new technologies and content for those new technologies. And in the case of... It's interesting that, you know... I think you wrote a really great piece on this recently on kind of like the Bake Off being a good example of nobody would have commissioned it for commercial, but our public service broadcaster did, and now that's a massive hit. And those are the sorts of things that you want the public service broadcasters to do. So I'm not sure if you can define, you know, how different a public service drama is, but certainly you want the opportunity to defend and allow our public service broadcasters to take risk. And sometimes they're not always going to get it right. Mm. But sometimes they'll get a sleeper hit, and that's the trade-off, I think. I don't know if you agree, Andrew.
Well, Jed Mercurio's Bodyguard was a very straightforward thriller, and on those terms it worked brilliantly. And I talked to him, I said to him when I interviewed him, it sounds like I know these people, I just freshly have to meet them. And I said, do you feel sorry for Vanity Fair? This was after his first episode had done really well, and the next Sunday it was going to be Vanity Fair was going to hit back, as it were. I said, it's going to die, isn't it, Vanity Fair? Don't you feel sorry for them? And he said, well, not really. Just a notebook, isn't it? This is mine is original British writing, fresh from my mind, contemporary drama about terrorism. So he would say he was doing the public service broadcasting. I think Polly Hill, who commissioned Vanity Fair for ITV, is a no-BBC hand, head of BBC drama. And I probably think, she's worked with Gwyneth Hughes a lot, wanted to do a piece that would have probably worked better on BBC One for ITV. She says, Polly Hill says some ridiculous things at the launch, like Becky Sharp's a very ITV heroine. It's just... She was talking herself into it. I was always dubious whether it would work on ITV. And in fact, only a few... It's just trends, all this stuff. A few years ago, ITV would say, we don't do classic series, we do original drama. We do period drama. We look at the Edwardian era. Look at Downton Abbey. That was their riposte. And they would hold that up as public service broadcasting, in a sense. Public service broadcasting was originally to inform, educate and entertain. I think the least of those was to entertain, but the BBC's always had to entertain, or people would say, why are we paying a fine, a licence, a fee every year to a series of stations that we don't actually watch? So the entertainment thing, I would say, funds the public service broadcasting element of the BBC rather than is intrinsic to its mission.
What Tony Hall said in his speech is that audiences expect a great range of original homegrown drama, comedy, documentary, sport, music, entertainment and journalism. And they want that whole service from a publicly funded service. James, do you think that in this day and age is right, or actually can a lot of that now be provided by other people?
No, it's absolutely right. I think... When I moved to the UK from Australia and I had to pay the licence fee, I was outraged. I was like, what was this? Why am I paying for television? But you kind of look at the tradition of public service here, and it's one of the finest media systems in the world for creating an independent voice, for creating a space in which, as best as possible within media environments, they create diversity of content. Not as much diversity of voices as people would like, and rightly so. They stand up to criticism and the balancing act, kind of year in, year out of be popular but not too popular, be critical but not too critical. This kind of thing can't be done with market forces. And if you put public service broadcasting into a market failure space where it's only meant to work where the market doesn't, you don't end up with the richness of content. We were talking earlier about just some of the things that seem really silly as risks that BBC is able to take because it has a remit to be slightly different, like having the controversial thing of two female presenters on primetime television, and how that's just something you don't see on other channels, on Strictly Come Dancing, a primetime show with two female presenters. And yet when I go back to Australia and I watch the television there, it's a very particular type of woman who's on television, who's very young, who's very attractive, and is always accompanied by an elder, a male figure. Not so attractive, and that kind of thing is rampant in America as well. And it's just that kind of thing we take for granted here. But when you travel and look at other media systems, there's so much kind of like cultural value that having a strong public service ecosystem provides. It's crucial, I think, in this moment.
It's kind of embodied by our rival, isn't it, Mary Beard?
Yeah.
Which other commercial service would have a woman of that age talking seriously about the arts on every Friday night?
Yeah, absolutely.
And she's fantastic.